Adam Leith Gollner, The Book of Immortality. Adam, early in the book, he writes about something that happened to you when you were just a teenager. Can you tell me about that?
Are you referring to the near-death experience?
I am, yes.
Yes. Well, what happened was my family had moved to Budapest shortly after communism ended. And we lived next to a soccer field, which belonged to a school where we went to class. And then we'd play soccer there every afternoon. And one day somebody brought a BB gun to the soccer field. And we all took turns firing it. It was unloaded. And then somebody put it down on the bench and we went to play a game. And my team lost. And as a joke, I picked up the gun, which I had assumed was still unloaded. And as a joke, I placed it in my mouth and pulled the trigger. Unfortunately, somebody had put a BB pellet in the gun while we were playing soccer. So it was, in fact, loaded. And the little round pellet went through my tongue, tunneled through the length of my tongue, came out the back of my tongue, and ended up in the fleshy part of my throat, at the back of my throat near the spinal cord. And normally that would be something that would be extremely painful, but it didn't hurt at all. And what happened instead was I kind of leapt out of my usual perspective and hovered up a few meters above myself and watched as a tremendous amount of blood poured out of my mouth. And then it kind of happened in this warped temporality. It was a very slow, fast moment. And then leapt back into my usual perspective and realized I was in a lot of trouble and went to the hospital and, you know, they took the pellet out and it never hurt. That's what's so strange. It never hurt.
Maybe that's the funniest part about it. How old were you at the time? 13 or so?
Yeah, I was 14, I think, maybe 13 or 14. And, you know, even though it was in some way an out-of-body experience or, you know, something that people would refer to as a near-death experience, I never felt that it was proof of anything. It never offered me any sort of certainty about something to come after death.
But I'm curious because you've obviously thought about it a number of times over the year and its years. Mm-hmm. And while it may not have been a death experience, it certainly was. It must have felt very threatening at the time. Was that when you got kind of interested in the question of immortality?
It's hard to say. You know, I think that we all are interested in the question of immortality from the earliest times that we start wondering what happens after death, if anything. A friend of mine just had a child recently who's only recently begun to talk. And she said, "Mummy, you know what happens when we die?" And she said, "Oh, my God.
Not ready for that question."
It's a mystery, is what she said. And I thought that was such a great answer. I don't know. I don't know if that was the beginning for me. It certainly was the beginning of thinking, wow, that's pretty strange that, you know, the pellet was lodged so close to my spinal cord. I mean, I was just millimeters away from paralysis or worse. And yet, you know, nothing bad came of it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So when did you begin to think seriously about immortality as a subject to write about?
Well, I know that I wrote about it in university. I had a professor, a film professor, who's one of the world's great authorities on Ingmar Bergman, the Scandinavian filmmaker who directed Seventh Seal, amongst others. And this professor also happened to be a Jesuit priest. And so he would force us to watch these films, these European avant-garde films that, you know, thrust us into existentialist angst, trying to figure out, you know, the meaning of life. And I remember one of my early essays for him was just a total debunking of the idea of something to come after life, after death. You know, just I don't believe in it. There is nothing. There's no proof. You know, a full, almost atheist, beyond agnostic. And he, you know, his comments were, "Well, how are you so sure?" And I remember thinking, "Well, I don't know how I'm so sure. I just know." And then I guess that was I became a TA for him, a teaching assistant, and over the years took a lot of courses with him. So that may have been when I started writing about immortality.
Yeah, I can imagine that there were serious discussions after that. You could throw right back at him, "How can you be so sure?" And I imagine you did from time to time.
Yeah, we had some pretty passionate debates. When I started writing this book about 5 years ago, I realized pretty quickly that I was lost in the subject, and I didn't really know how to go about writing about immortality, even though I was fascinated by why it is that in these supposedly secular times, so many of us continue to believe in life after death, amongst other things, as well as physical immortality, which is equally fascinating. But I went to go see him, and I said, can you help me understand this? And he at that point had he had Alzheimer's, and he was in an infirmary for Jesuit priests, and his short-term memory was pretty much gone. But we could still get into these meaty conversations once we bypassed the short-term memory. And yeah, we had some really, really fascinating conversations.
I imagine those were in the back of your mind throughout this. You talk to a lot of people about immortality, not just religious people, but a number of religious figures about the way they view death and what comes after it. Was there one particular person you interviewed that you thought really gave you an insight into why it is that so many of us at least want to believe that death isn't the end?
I noticed something in common with all of the spiritual leaders I spoke with, whether it was a Hasidic rabbi or a Jesuit priest or a Sufi imam or a Buddhist nun. They all had one thing in common, which was they said, you know, it's fine for you to come here and want to understand belief, but we aren't believers. We know. We know what will come after death. We know what happens to the soul. Like in our belief system, it's not belief. It's knowledge. And that really fascinated me. Like I kept on seeing that over and over again. Like don't these people see that there's no certainty here? But for them, there is certainty because they have faith. And what I learned from all of them is that belief is this mirage that provides the illusion of certainty. And for them, it's no longer just belief. It's certainty.
Wow. And this was true across faiths and non-faiths too, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that nowhere do you see that more than in these, you know, supposed physical immortalists, people who have a desire to never die, for their bodies to stay physically intact until, I want to say the end of time, but even beyond the end of time, forever. And it's an interesting kind of movement because it's so scientific. It's like the most radical, futuristic, scientistic movement. But I think it's so completely a modern appropriation of this ancient mythology about eternal life, just transposed into a kind of cybernetic era.
Well, of course, you look back to the history of this, and it's a subject that has fascinated mankind for thousands of years. If you look just at recent things, though, look at all the science fiction about immortal life. Robert Heinlein wrote about it. George Bernard Shaw wrote a whole series of plays about that. Elements in Greek mythology where it worked well or badly to to be immortal. It's clear that people want to think about this.
It's clear that we're all faced with this profound question, which is, what does death mean? You know, why is it there? It's kind of senseless. It doesn't make any sense to us. Why, you know, we can't quite grasp it. Why do we have to die? We know, you know, most of us accept that it's real, that we are mortal. Some of us don't. But at the same time, when we lose somebody, it's such a kind of perplexing situation. The grief can throw us into a complete, what's called a meaning threat, where things don't make sense because we can't quite compute. Like our consciousness cannot envision a lack of consciousness. There's this bug built into the operating system where it just doesn't make sense. And so we have to create these alternate narratives. We could even say alternate endings to go with the theme of the show. But we have to have some way of envisioning what death is. We have to say either it's a complete stop, you know, and we believe that consciousness is just, you know, something that's happening between the neurons in our brain and nothing more. Or we side with the vast majority of people, which is, depending on the survey, somewhere between 75 and 95% of us who believe in life after death. And we say there is something more to come. There's some sort of person permanence out there, and some part of us, our soul or our spirit or our consciousness, lives on in some indeterminate afterlife.
One of the interesting things about this, it seems to me, is that there is this wide-ranging belief that there must be something, or we want there to be something. And yet the people who believe different things, or they know, in their terms, different things. But there are also commonalities through these. You devote a whole chapter in the book to the importance of water symbolism in all these systems of immortality. Were you surprised to find that?
I guess so. I mean, I had known that some of them would be there. You know, the idea of the water of life and the fountain of youth, they're clearly symbolic of eternal life. And of course, it makes sense. You know, water keeps us alive. We need to drink water to stay alive. And all forms of life require water, from plants to animals to you know, everything that lives, like water kind of moves through it. And so we have to you know, try to place ourselves in the minds of our ancestors who were looking at this, and they said, oh, you know, the ordinary miraculousness of water may be something that also it goes beyond just the ordinary. Like, perhaps if it keeps us alive, it could make us live forever. And also there's something about the way that water kind of shuttles through the cyclicality of rain ending up on in the ground in the ocean and evaporating back on up to the clouds and coming down. I don't know when we first realized that that's what happens, but I'm sure it was something that you know, mystified us. And the idea that maybe, you know, just as rain dies onto the ground and we die into the ground, but then it also, some part of it lifts up, some invisible part of it goes back up and then comes back down. Maybe something like that happens to us as well. Hmm. I know that there's one of the founders of scientific anthropology, E.B. Tyler is his name. He said that every civilization that ever contemplated a sunset near a body of water came up with their own iteration of a fountain of youth tale, because they said, you know, if the sun dies into the water each night and then returns the following day, well, maybe so do we.
Fountain of Youth has been another thing that has come through, and there are many of them, I gather, around the world. But you did visit the one that we've all heard about, the one in St. Augustine, Florida.
I spent a wonderful week or so in St. Augustine trying to track down the fabled Fountain of Youth that supposedly brought Ponce de Leon here to these shores. It was such a wonderful place where everything was almost, but not quite real.
It is a story that everybody's heard of, and one of the great things about it, of course, is that he found it and then didn't tell anybody where it was, so nobody's found it since. But some of them claim they have, haven't they?
Well, I know that you are leading into a question about David Copperfield, the magician. Am I right?
Well, yes, of course. I'm curious, I guess, and I think it's, you've raised it, and I think it's worth talking about some of the experiences you had in St. Augustine, because it kind of sets you up to go on to David Copperfield, doesn't it?
Yeah. It seemed really like a natural segue from the Fountain of Youth in Florida, or the Fountains of Youth, because there's numerous, it turns out, in St. Augustine. There's many, not just in St. Augustine, but all over Florida. That's part of the beauty of the Sunshine State. And so, yes, David Copperfield, master illusionist, greatest magician of our time, issued a press release a few years ago saying that he had found the Fountain of Youth on his private islands in the Bahamas. And what he said is that you can take dead insects and put them in the water and they fly away. And
wow.
You can take brown leaves and put them in the water and they become green again. And I thought, I wish I could be the reporter that goes to his private island to find out what's really going on there.
I bet you weren't the only one who really wanted to go there. What is it called, Musha Cay?
Yeah, I think Musha Cay or Musha Cay, depending on how you pronounce C-A-Y.
Okay.
Musha Cay,
I think. It's what, 11 islands? It's a little archipelago in the Bahamas?
Yeah, it's a relatively large archipelago, given that he's the sole proprietor. It's a scattering of islands in this beautiful Caribbean Sea, and on one of these islands, he claims to have found a liquid that reverses genes. I don't know how many other reporters really wanted to go and track down this story. Apparently, he was pretty widely mocked for suggesting this, and everybody just said, oh, it's a scam, you know, because you can rent out these islands. You can go and stay there, and that's the idea. It costs $35,000 a night plus tax with a minimum five-night stay. And so...
And he has some people who are willing to pay that, presumably for the possibility of finding the Fountain of Youth.
Who knows? I mean, the way he puts it is he says he's in the billionaire business. And so, the only people who are going to go there are people who can spend $250,000 on a weekend getaway. And some of the people who've done that are people like the founders of Google. Sergey Brin got married there or had his honeymoon there. And I found that to be quite interesting because he's been one of the people who's really been helping finance the technological developments that may potentially lead to certain breakthroughs in longevity and anti-aging. So it's interesting. Clearly, he had a fascination with that idea.
I can imagine. Now, you must be a very persuasive man because you did, in fact, go to Mushuké, didn't you? And you didn't pay $35,000 a night or stay 5 days to do your research.
I stayed 3 days with David Copperfield, and it was an amazing trip. The best part to me was when he agreed to have this long, hard scrabbled interview where I asked him all the difficult questions. Part of our negotiation about this story happening was he said, you can come to the island, but I will not show you the fountain. I won't show it to you. If you think you're going to see my wrinkled hand go into a stream of water and come out young, you're crazy. And I remember he said that people would crucify him if they saw that. And I thought, what an interesting analogy to make.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't show it to me, but he would discuss it with me with, as he put it, great verbal aplomb.
So did he explain how it worked?
He said that he'd hired a team of biologists and scientists to study exactly how it's working. He said that what it is it's a liquid that reverses genes. And he said that he hasn't been able to figure out exactly what it does or how it works, but that it is not a magic trick. He made a clear distinction between what he calls puffery, meaning his stage magic and his illusions, and finding a liquid that reverses genes.
Now, he didn't show it to you. He was only willing to talk to you about it. Did he offer any evidence of its efficiency, of its efficacy?
Well, part of the reason that I did decide to go down there, even though he said he wouldn't show it to me, is I thought, well, fine, I'm going to just sneak out at night and find it. And so...
So you did.
Did you sneak out? I did, definitely.
What happened?
Because there was this one part of the island that was this rather eerie body of water, and it was called the Sanctuary. And I was sure that that's what it was because it's such a strange, murky water and all these bleached, white, brittle, kind of dead trees around it. It was such an unbelievable setting. And I thought, this must be what it is. I mean, why else would they call it? They called it the Petrified Lake also. And I thought, what is that? What is a petrified lake? And so I should ask you, though,
I mean, when you were in St. Augustine, wasn't there one of the fountains that you went to where the local people said, taste that water once and you'll never taste it again? That must have been in the back of your mind when you went looking for this Fountain of Youth on David Copperfield's island.
I mean, obviously, I knew that the Fountain of Youth can't possibly be real. But by that same token, I was willing to suspend my disbelief. And that's really where magic comes in. I mean, that's the beauty and the strength of great magic is that it makes us believe that something impossible might actually be true.
So David Copperfield really did sort of change your understanding of immortality.
Well, how about we say this? He helped me suspend my disbelief for the purposes of telling a story. I mean, he really gave me a story. I don't know if he changed my beliefs on the idea of immortality, but again, he did help me understand the meaning of belief.
Now, from the way you're talking, of course, it sounds as though you did not find the Fountain of Youth, which doesn't mean that he doesn't have it, but...
I wouldn't be so sure. I think you'll have to read that section and see what's there.
There are others that we probably ought to talk about that are, I think, certifiably bizarre, if not crazy. There was, for instance, right after World War I, what you call the gland craze. What was that all about?
That is such a bizarre chapter in medical history. And the fact that we have this generalized amnesia about all the things we've done before in the past to try to live forever is so fascinating. Like, we willingly want to forget all the things we've done because each new generation comes up with their own vision about how to attain this elusive prize, immortality. And then we don't remember. we kind of bury what the past generations did. So,
well, let's remember for a moment. I think this one's worth bringing up just so that people can forget it if they want to.
The gland craze of the 1920s was when people thought that somehow the elixir of life resided in our hormones and in glands, and perhaps there was a way to take glands from animals, whether it be goats or apes, chimpanzees and baboons, and graft them into our own bodies. And there was a famous clinic in France, Sergei Voronoff's clinic on the Riviera, where men would go to pay to have ape testicles grafted into their own scrotums in the hopes that it would rejuvenate them.
Wow. I think that's the best word I can come up with to describe that. Now, was there any evidence of success?
There is no evidence of success, obviously. But what's interesting is that when you look back at the newspapers of the time, they all thought that this was legitimate science. You know, nobody was saying, I mean, some people were dubious about it, but the New York Times was writing about this on the front page. Like, this was the great breakthrough. We'd found it, the glandular hormone treatment of eternal life. And that's what's so interesting about it, is that Sergei Voronoff wasn't a quack. He just thought he had found it, but he was wrong. And it shows how we can deceive ourselves so easily. We're so willing to fall into unthinkingness in our desperation to find immortality.
Well, and a little bit of success, not with immortality, of course, but with rejuvenation, can go a long way. Was it? You mentioned goat transfers. Wasn't there a Dr. Brinkley who had some success putting goat testicles on men?
Dr. Brinkley was another one of these these gland doctors. Now, he certainly attained financial success by performing these operations, but I don't know if he genuinely rejuvenated anybody. The placebo effect is a very powerful thing, and the things that can make us feel like we're younger aren't necessarily grounded in any valid reasons why that's actually happening.
Of course, this is something that has fascinated people. And as you say, everybody sort of wants to take it seriously. Does that get in the way of serious scientists now who are studying aging?
Well, yeah, it's a mixed blessing. And I think that there's a tendency for people to be a little bit breathless when it comes to discoveries that are happening. And there certainly have been genuine, important breakthroughs happening in anti-aging science. We know more than we've ever known about how to increase lifespans in simple organisms from yeast and fruit flies up until mice. So we've found certain genetic pathways that can be altered and modified in order to increase lifespans and prolong health span as well. So far, however, it's very important to remember that none of those have had any human applications yet. There is not a single thing that is proven to prolong life in humans. And so the complicated thing is accepting on the one hand that there have been these important discoveries that are being made and will continue to be made, but then balancing that with our own hopes and desires for our own lifespans and our own longevity. So I think that reliable scientists need to be really cautious and really almost moderate in explaining how things work to the public. But of course, there's such scientists need to make money as well, and they need to get funding, and they need to get financing. And so it really helps when you have a great story and you say, like, guess what? We figured out that we can target sirtuins, and we can create a pill that will allow people to eat whatever they want while still getting the benefits of caloric restriction, and it'll make them live forever. And then, you know, GlaxoSmithKline invests $1 billion in it. So, yeah, it's I think that the people to trust are the people who aren't out there making grandiose claims, but rather working on the incremental advances that is what makes science what it truly is.
I suppose some of those non-claims are the reason that so many of us use various creams and potions and pills, even though the best they can hope to do is show that it does smooth your skin out for a day or two or an hour or two.
It's so hard to find real answers in the world of those creams and potions. And you know what? Some of them do work, but often they work just as well as placebos. And that's what's interesting, is if we want it to work, it can work. And that's such a misunderstood part of the human psyche, is how is it that that's happening? Why is it that, you know, we think we're on painkillers, but we're not, but then we still don't feel the pain? Like, what is going on in the poppy fields of the mind, as they call it? So placebo is such an interesting, powerful effect. And it seems that many of the wrinkle creams, like even the ones that really are supposedly proven to work, like, they can have an effect. That, like, let's be clear, they can work for people if they believe that they will work, but often they only work marginally better than placebos.
That's been behind some of the theories of immortality too, hasn't it? I mean, in some of the literature, some of the novels, the fiction about it, it comes down to, if you believe you will live forever, you will live forever.
I think that's a true statement.
Now, everybody wants to think about what the future is going to be like, and some people sort of act on it, I guess. You attended a 2068 party in California. Is that what that was?
That was a party that was held by a group of physical immortalists to celebrate the supposed 125th birthday of one of their members, and it was going to take place in the year 2068. So everybody had to show up in costumes, in period garb, the way we would dress in the year 2068.
So what did you wear?
I went with some friends, and we kind of wore silver bodysuits to look like, you know, members of the future, so we could blend in.
Did you blend in?
I think so. I mean, everybody was crazy there, so we were just, you know, we were just as crazy as everybody else. I think the greatest discovery there was the fact that that Aubrey de Grey, one of the great proponents of what he calls ending aging, happened to come to this party. And I was so thrilled because I'd been wanting to interview him, and there we had a chance to do the interview right then and there. It was also interesting to hear these amateur hobbyists, immortalists. They at one point in the party, people were able to get up in front of everybody else and talk about how we had attained immortality by the year 2068. So they all gave their stories and their versions of how humanity had accomplished this great dream.
Did you hear anything new there from them?
Well, no. It was kind of repeating the stories that we've all heard from, mainly from Ray Kurzweil and Aubrey de Grey, you know, that there's going to be a way of curing every disease that mankind has ever had, and we're going to upload our minds into computers, and we're going to have tiny nanobots patrolling our bloodstream, and we're going to get rid of our organs, and we're going to become cyborgs, and we're going to download our memories into clones all over the world wherever we want, and we're going to have perfect sex with sex bots. I mean, it's the same old story always.
Looking back on this, what was the most surprising thing you learned in your research?
I would really say that what surprised me more than anything was how we can feel like we know when we're just believing. The way that we replace knowledge with belief, and the way we switch so easily and so fluidly between one and the other. To me, it really astonished me that all of these spiritual leaders and many of these scientific believers as well were so certain that they understood something that cannot be understood, which is, what does death mean?
Well, let's use that to move on, because we've talked about immortality and the efforts to find immortality. How do you feel now, after all this research, about death?
I mean, I think death is real. I believe death is real. There are some people who I interviewed who find that to be an offensive statement, and they would say that I'm what's called a deathist, and that deathism is something that needs to be eliminated, like other isms, like sexism and racism, and that we are, people like me, are holding us back from humanity's greatest potential accomplishment, which is living forever, and that we all need to change our thinking and just believe that we can live forever, and then we will live forever. But I don't subscribe to that theory of thought. I don't believe that. I believe that we're here for a brief, extraordinary moment, and that we should make the most of it while we're here.
After all this, do you have a way you would choose to die if you got a choice?
I think, I have no idea, but probably going in your sleep is the best way to go. So I would choose that. I think, you know, just peacefully passing on.
And is there anything after that?
I have no certainty on that topic. I don't know. How about that?
I think that may be where we have to leave it. Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's a fascinating subject, isn't it? I'm with you. I've watched enough of my family go now that I don't believe anybody else has the secret.
Yeah. There are many answers, but we can just choose which one is the one that we relate to.
Choose the one you like the best. Go from there. Yeah. Thanks again. That was great.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.